Back with you. New week, Monday, March 8th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. In the 3 p.m. hour, security consultant Adam Roosevelt joined us to talk about the changing face of what may or may not be going on in the Middle East now that the Biden White House has taken over. Governor Ned Lamont in the 4 p.m. hour with more encouraging news on the state's COVID-19 situation. And Chris Herb joined us in the 5 o'clock hour, the head of the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, on a proposed new gasoline tax in a climate bill.
It may be getting a little testy overseas. Again, new occupant of the White House. So are some of the usual suspects there trying to shake things up? Recently, at least 10 rockets targeting a military base in western Iraq that, yes, houses U.S.-led coalition troops. Our next guest has some thoughts on that. Former Army combat veteran, now CEO of security firm AR International Consulting, Adam Roosevelt is the guest. Hey, Adam, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to be here with you.
Adam, thank you. I love when I get guys like you who have a unique perspective, having been in combat and kind of being awash in this stuff. Yeah, that rocket attack a few days ago on that military base in western Iraq. Should we, Adam, be surprised by this or not? And what were your immediate thoughts when you saw what happened there?
You know, Paul, I'll tell you, my immediate thoughts are interesting because I've got a daughter now, and I've got to explain that to her, what's going on around the world. I've had to hang up the boots, if you will, and kind of get down to a more simple engagement with my children about this. And I'll tell you what I would say. I'll say that, you know, we're in this great competition right now. Call it chess, call it warfare, pick a term. I think right now things are going to heat up, and I'll say why is because there were some actions made against some very important personnel in Iran, actually, and that's why we've seen some actions going forward, Paul, and I think this is the tipping point between the U.S. and Iran, and I think we're going to see some activity in very key locations like what we saw just recently.
Do you think the Iranians and the IRGC, Adam, were they biding their time, hopefully waiting for, and they got their wish for President Trump to be defeated and now maybe want to get back even for the takeout of General Soleimani that Mr. Trump okayed?
You know, Paul, you hit it right on the top of the head. I think that they have been looking for an opportunity, not just waiting for President Trump's, you know, eventual exit or him to still be the president. I think they were planning to see what was going to be their next move. They've always had it in their military plan to focus on the United States, but they just needed a reason. And I think we gave them a reason with the Soleimani attack and as well as the scientist attack. So they're looking for anything further to kind of make a decision and have some justification to say the U.S. was responsible for pushing us over the edge.
And when you talk about the scientist attack, Adam, you're speaking about the takeout of that Iranian scientist, which many people, Adam, I guess, and I don't know whether you have a different opinion on this, a lot of people pointing to Israeli forces and the Mossad for at least being part of that.
You know, I would say the U.S. is a coalition-focused military member. This is a great power competition. NATO's involved. Our partners are involved in the intelligence community. You know, so I don't think, my professional perspective here is that the Israelis would move without having some contingency in form of a coalition, you know, the White House being briefed on these type of activities occurring in the region. So I would say that they're going to coordinate in some fashion with intelligence on the ground or sharing intel to make the best decision for the coalition long term.
Former Army combat veteran Adam Roosevelt is the guest. He's now the CEO of security firm AR International Consulting. Back with more from Adam Roosevelt. Adam, hang on. Back with you momentarily. Hang in there. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. Former Army combat veteran and CEO of the security firm AR International Consulting is the guest, Adam Roosevelt, and we should delve into this, folks, because, yeah, there are still American servicemen and women, thousands of them, all around the world. We came off of 4 years with Mr. Trump with no new involvements. We'll hope if that, see if that hopefully continues. Adam, the recent revelations surrounding the Saudis and the death of Mr. Khashoggi, would the intelligence world be now worried or not, you tell me, about the government publicly fingering the Saudis here, although not really doing anything about it, right, publicly naming names, because the Saudis are on our side. Whether we like what they do in their country, that's a different thing. But if it ever came to the worst scenario with Iran, we need the Saudis on our side, don't we?
We definitely do, Paul. I think it's important to know the history of how far we've come and how long it takes to build a coalition. We've always played tug of war in the space of international conflicts. So I would say we definitely need the Saudis, but we also need to make sure we uphold our principles as well, because I think that's what keeps America the number one country, the number one leader in the space, and we can't forget that, Paul, for sure.
You know, when in the latter part of the Trump years, when his son-in-law was able to broker these kinds of agreements with some of these Middle Eastern countries with respect to Israel, you know, some people said, well, that's a very real big deal. And other people were saying, well, it's just a bunch of arms deals. So you're kind of buying their cooperation. What did you think and what do you think, Adam, of those deals, which maybe, hopefully, cross our fingers, is going to maybe turn down the rhetoric and the heat a little bit in the coming years in the Middle East?
It's a great question, and I'll tell you that I think it's more than money when you have countries coming together. I think there's so many things that go into that planning process, Paul. You've got diplomatic relations. You've got commitment of boots on the ground where people are actually going to deploy a military force to support counterterrorism. You know, it's not just the line item, hey, we put $20 billion on a piece of paper. There are an extreme amount of things that are kind of in the parallel that are kind of moving together to build this coalition to make sure that it works. So I think that, you know, this current administration's got a lot to work on based on what has been built by the Trump administration. They won't be able to just roll back things, Paul. I think they've got to take a look at really what good has come from what Trump had did, and then move forward with building on those building blocks and not taking a step backwards.
Adam, there are undoubtedly thousands of people listening to us right now in the greater Fairfield County area and also in the North Shore of Long Island who I know listen, who have relatives, sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, nieces, nephews, stepkids, or they themselves may be Army and military veterans, or they may have their loved ones going in right now. What would you say to those people listening right now, Adam, who are concerned about their loved ones going into the military? If they asked you, Adam, you know, I have my daughter, my son, granddaughter, grandson in the military now, what is the state of the U.S. military as you see it?
You know, I'll tell them to continue to have trust. You know, I served 10 years in the U.S. military. You know, it's not just going in and letting your young son or young daughter go into the military without understanding that there's a system around it that keeps our people safe, trained, ready to fight, and effectively bring our folks home. Yeah, we're a part of this mission as well, even after the service, to continue to advocate for the training, the funding, the intelligence components that keep our folks safe. So we're doing that 24/7 every day to keep our people safe and bring them home. And yes, we do have casualties, but we're doing everything we possibly can to protect the homeland and send the heroes to the issues that bring them home in one piece.
Your company, AR International, helps governments and corporations protect themselves from security threats. Adam, in your mind, let's stick with governments here, but I know the commercial end of it is also important. But as far as governments are concerned, the Western world, the U.S. and all, and our European allies, what would you say are the one or two biggest threats that we're looking at, Adam, in the next maybe 2, 3, 4 years? What are you really worried about?
You know, I am really worried, Paul, about insider threat. You know, we've got so many issues with governments coming in, foreign governments coming into the U.S., buying property, getting involved in leveraging their money and power to kind of slowly but surely capture a large part of our market. We see that with China. We see that with Russia. And these things are going to become a problem for us long term. They're on the track now, Paul, effectively to outpace the U.S. economically by 2028. The second thing I would say is technology, innovation, and IP. a lot of it's being stolen, whether it be cyber attacks, whether it be, you know, just insiders coming in and stealing intellectual property. You know, the market there to steal property like this puts us at a disadvantage long term as a country. So I would say insider threat, technological innovations, and intellectual property protections are kind of two of our really big issues right now. And if we don't get ahead of that, I think we'll be in a very degraded situation going forward as a country.
How, Adam, in your mind, do we slow down China? Because Beijing will say anything, and they'll smile at you, and they'll sign whatever you want them to sign, Adam, and then they'll do the exact opposite. Is there any slowing down? And I'm always careful to say this is, we point this, Adam, at the Chinese government, not the good people of China who just want to be happy and raise kids, but the Chinese Communist Party, emphasis on the word communist. How do you slow them down?
I would first say we need to focus on their foreign investment. You know, they operate like a corporation, Paul, and they don't just integrate into the businesses. They have an entire plan. We saw what happened with Eric Swalwell, and there's just individuals who've been trained to integrate and assimilate into our most powerful institutions, Congress, business. I would say my focus would be the foreign investments. I've hit them where the money is. I've hit them where they're putting their money in U.S. corporations. Let's slow down their ability to have control in the boardrooms and really decide the future of the majority of our decisions across a very dynamic space, Paul. And I think that's one of the ways we can get ahead of this, because money is power.
And yet on the military side, Adam, they don't slow down. I mean, you see now the saber rattling going on with Hong Kong and also with Taiwan, and what they continue to do, you know, basically annexing the South China Sea. It's almost, Adam, like they're looking for a fight.
You know, Paul, they are, and they're a very aggressive country. Our nation, and I'll say that they've taken it to the next step, Paul. They're now doing genome modification to enhance soldiers now. It's the movie era of military, but it's the actual reality of what we're looking at. They're not afraid to push the pendulum. We have to meet them in that space with aggressive innovation and making sure we compete, because a great power competition is happening. And if the United States lags, they will be on our battlefield space and be very capable and outpace us militarily, economically, and we just can't afford that as a first world country who's the leader of the free world.
10-year Army combat veteran, now CEO of security firm AR International Consulting, helping governments and big corporations protect themselves from emerging security threats. Adam Roosevelt has been the guest. Adam, thank you. We appreciate the time. Take care.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. All right, folks, there you go. From an Army combat veteran, says the military has still got it going, but a lot of threats, a lot of threats.
As you probably know, the American Rescue Act passed $1.9 trillion, really thanks to Dick Blumenthal, our amazing congressional delegation, and special thanks to Senator Chris Murphy, who worked hard to make sure that our state municipalities and superintendents had the flexibility and time to make sure this money was really well spent. And I'm going to ask him just to say a few things, in particular his focus on kids and folks with disabilities. And Melissa, as you know, runs the Office of Policy and Management. You'll have some questions for her, I'm sure, about when do we get the money? How do we access the money? And you won't be totally satisfied with the answer, because we're still waiting for guidance from Treasury, but we'll do the best that we can. That said, let me just give you an abbreviated version of our COVID summary. I think basically the good news, this numbers go back to Friday, is top positivity rate continues to stay low. The hospitalizations goes down, so it's the lowest we've had in months. You know, that was key for us. And fatalities, that's 21. That's over 3 days. Thank God that number is trending down as well. Don't lift your guard. I mean, it's worth remembering that the variant, used to be known as the UK variant, has gone from about in the 40s to 81, you know, in the last week. So we watch that carefully, but it's worth knowing it's not going up exponentially. It's going up more linear, but it's still something that we pay special attention to. and very, very low incidence of the South African variant. So we think we have a good handle on where we are, at least right now, in terms of the infections. And part of the thanks goes to the vaccine program, which is rolling out pretty successfully. You know, really special thanks to all of our partners on this, federally qualified health centers, the healthcare providers, really making an extra effort to get to the underserved populations. As you can see, we've got about 75% of the 75 and aboves. That's where the bulk of the complications are. Almost 65% of the 65 and above, little parallel there. 25% of the 55 to 64, and we're going to ramp that up. So it's over half of those over 55 have received their first shot of the vaccine. We'll have an overwhelming majority of those 55 and above will have their first shot by March 19th, which, as you remember from last week, is the day we continue to cautiously reopen. 137,000 doses are scheduled for delivery, already arriving right now. So for those of you who said, oh, my God, my appointment is put off for 3-4 weeks, what do I do? Remember, there's 137 new appointments that are being made available this week. So feel free to check in. If you get a better appointment date, please cancel the later one. And about 11,000 doses of J&J have been administered to date. American Rescue Plan, you've heard a lot about it, $1.9 trillion. I think it meets the moment. I've heard all the complaints. My God, how come it's for more than a mask and ventilation? And why isn't it just specific to COVID healthcare? And why does it go on beyond December 31? I think because the effects, the long-term effects of COVID are going to go on way beyond December 31. I know what that means for our kids. I know what that means in terms of our economy. I know what that means to small business. I know what that means in terms of stabilizing our municipal and state budget going forward. So I, for one, am very thankful that you're going to see $2.6 billion in state relief, give or take, and $1.6 billion for towns and municipalities, local relief. And that money is supposed to be allocated through the end of 2024. So there's a few years here. So we're working hard to balance that out, make sure that the monies are invested in the most significant way where we can make an enormous difference. I'm sorry for those that say, hey, great, let's use all this money to reduce taxes. I take it that is not allowed. This is supposed to be incremental, and nor can you just pour it in the, pay off old pensions. This is money that's going to be invested to make a difference for people. And let me give you a couple of examples in the next slide. So the American Rescue Plan, school support, learning, development catch-up. Here, Chris is going to talk. Let me just say a couple of things. We've had more of our schools open than just about anybody else. Most of our schools, almost all of them, for in-person learning, going back to September. But we still have a couple hundred thousand kids that didn't feel comfortable going back to school. And they've been out of school for close to a year now. So what we do with this education funding is significant. It starts the day after school ends in June. And we're going to talk very specifically about the ways we get these kids back engaged. And it's, STEM and learning and 3 R's and book and classroom and lost learning is really important, but also getting these kids socialized and back with their peers. And some of the incredibly innovative programs we'll be able to afford, working with our camps, working with the not-for-profits, working with business for internships, ways that these kids can get back together, socializing with their peers and learning. The enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, that was about to end, I think, on the 14th or something. That will be extended another 6 months. I think it's a $300 plus up. We're working hard. Our old creaky computer system over at Department of Labor has had to do some, sprightly moving, but I think we're going to be very close to be able to get that adjudicated on time. So you'll see those monies relatively soon. Most quickest you'll probably get are the direct stimulus checks, hopefully within the next 2 or 3 weeks. That is money that comes directly from the federal government. That's $1,400 for folks earning up to a single, earning up to about $75,000 a year, more for a couple, more if you have kids. I'm very pleased with the child credit. I think that's really important. That's $3,600 a year per kid you have under the age of six, doing everything we can to make it easier for you to raise a family and make that affordable. It's super important now. We have, as you heard me say it probably too many times, we have fewer women, a lower participation factor in the workforce today than any time in the last 30 years. Women have been particularly hard hit by this pandemic, the first to lose their jobs, slower to get back, often enormous child care costs and other issues. This is the International Women's Day, I'm told. So I'm really pleased that the emphasis that the American Rescue Plan placed upon child care and daycare. We're going to have Beth Bai on very soon to say what we can do to expand the base of daycare, make that widely available, universally affordable, you know, for as long as we can do that, to give you the confidence that your kid is in good hands and that you can get back to work. A couple of other things, energy assistance and rental assistance, again, knowing that that doesn't end in the next 90 days, that we're going to have a glide path to allow you to pay those utility bills and to pay, you know, rent and mortgage. And there's some real support there as well. And finally, mental and behavioral health. And, you know, with that, I'm going to pass it over to Chris Murphy. But people know in no uncertain terms what this has meant in terms of stress, what this has meant in terms of trauma. We see that reflected in our 2-1-1 hotline. We see that reflection in domestic violence and addiction. And we hear that all the time in terms of our kids getting back in the game. And nobody's been more of a leader in doing what he can to help our kids than Chris Murphy. So, Chris, thank you for the great work you and Dick and the entire delegation did, and appreciate your work on behalf of the kids.
Thank you very much, Governor. Thanks for inviting me to say a few words today on behalf of the delegation. But first, just let me quickly return the compliment. Obviously, we you know, I've been very proud to be able to tell Connecticut's story over the course of this pandemic. Early on, Connecticut was a hotspot through no fault of our own, and we turned the corner over the course of the spring and summer faster than any other state because of your leadership and the fact that we just have a can-do attitude in our state, people willing to step up in the education sector, the healthcare sector, small business sector. And now we can tell the same story of success when it comes to vaccination rollouts. I was down in Hamden today at Cornell Hill-Scott Health Center's clinic, and they are getting those vaccines out as quickly as humanly possible. Every clinic I go to is so proud to tell me that, you know, over the course of the first 2 months, they've, you know, only wasted one shot, only lost two shots. I mean, it is absolutely exceptional how efficient our operation is. And I think Connecticut is going to meet those national targets faster than anybody. But I want to thank you for allowing me to come on and say a few words today and perhaps help answer any questions about the American Rescue Plan. You're right, this was a team effort. President Biden proposed this package. We made amendments in the Senate and the House. But by and large, this is the plan that the president ran on. This was the mandate that he was given. You know, President Biden said that he was going to run the White House in a way that unified rather than divided the country. And a lot of people were skeptical of whether he could do that. It's pretty stunning, the public reaction to this rescue plan, especially in the wake of the partisan nature of the transition. 70% of Americans, including 60% of Republicans, support what's in the American Rescue Plan. This is a package that has unified the country because, of course, this virus doesn't discriminate. And there is need in every sector of the country, regardless of what your politics are. I think, did a good job of summarizing what's in this bill. But you know, let me just talk a little bit about this from a very sort of personal standpoint. I started the day in New Haven. New Haven is a hardworking community, but it has a lot of folks, you know, that are, you know, working for barely over minimum wage. Well, if you're working, you know, at or around minimum wage, and you've got a couple of kids, the provisions of the American Rescue Plan are going to increase your take-home income over the course of the next year by about a third. And why we built the American Rescue Plan by building up from the bottom of the American economy, right? Putting money into the middle class and into poor families' pocketbooks is because we know that that money is then going to be spent in the Main Street economy. We know that those people are going to take that money and go out and spend it in small businesses and restaurants and retailers all around the state. We think this is a plan to power this economy to close to full employment. But as you mentioned, Governor, we also built this so that it will hopefully be the last relief package that Congress needs to undertake. This is, I think, the fifth relief package that Congress has passed. This is going to be passed by the House tomorrow, as I understand it, signed by the president later this week. But we want it to be the last one so that we can move on to other very important issues. And that's why, you know, we do recognize that the effects of COVID-19, the effects of this economic crisis, are going to last beyond 2021. And so we do provide for an allowance so that these dollars, whether they're the money that go to the states, $2.6 billion coming to Connecticut, the money going to cities, $676 million under this package, or the money going directly to schools, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion for Connecticut schools. We want to make sure that those monies are able to be used to deal with all of the aftershocks that come from COVID-19. That means we want to be able to stretch out support to our schools because the catch-up for learning loss is going to take a long time. We want to be able to stretch out support to small businesses so that we can give those businesses an on-ramp back to sustainability. And we want to make sure that the state has the ability to deal with the fact that there will be revenue loss that will, you know, last for years because of this unprecedented crisis. Lastly, Governor, you mentioned the role that I've played in the education title in this bill. And so I'll end by talking about some of the work that I and others helped lead to try to dot the I's and cross the T's when it came to the record education investment that we made through the American Rescue Plan. In particular, I wanted to make sure that we were spending money on special education students with high learning needs and on summer programming. Governor and I have talked a lot about the need to use this summer as an ability for kids to restart. Yes, some kids are going to need to spend some of the summer catching up with learning loss, but a lot of other kids are going to need to just have a really psychologically and emotionally healthy experience this summer. We're going to need to make sure that all of those kids that have been chronically absent, the kids who haven't signed on to online learning, who haven't shown up to in-person learning, that we get them into summer programs so that we can assess their emotional and educational well-being so that we can reset them for the upcoming school year when we hope that things will be back to normal. And so I'm excited to work with the governor and others to make sure that we, you know, expand out the number of affordable summer programming slots for kids in Connecticut. Excited to take these education dollars and make sure that we wrap services around the neediest kids in Connecticut. We have a lot of them, and they're going to need a lot of help, especially when schools reconvene in the fall. So I sit on the Education Committee and the Appropriations Committee, so glad to play a role there and look forward to working with the governor and his team on making sure those dollars land on the ground in a way that helps the kids who need the help the most. Thanks to my colleague, Dick Blumenthal, we work as a team. Obviously, we're blessed to have the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee representing Connecticut. The Child Care Tax Credit has been Rosa DeLauro's project for 20 years. She has been the leading proponent of expanding that. This bill, by expanding the child tax credit, will reduce child poverty in this country by 50%. That is a just extraordinary result of the American Rescue Plan. Governor, thanks for having me on, and thanks for being willing to keep in very close touch as we've worked on this plan and negotiated it through to near completion.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Chris is sticking around a little bit longer. Like I said, of course, Paul and Josh is here, and Melissa McCaw can do our best to answer questions right now in terms of the practicality of how this money is going to start to move.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Good afternoon, everyone. Based on the new CDC guidelines for fully vaccinated people being able to gather indoors with no mask on, do you think that's going to change any restrictions here in Connecticut?
Not for the near term. The CDC guidance said that, look, if you're hanging around with a lot of other people who have also been vaccinated, then you don't necessarily have to wear a mask if you're in a private setting, which is sort of good common sense, I think. You know, more broadly, though, it's going to still take another a month or two before the broad cross-section of people have been vaccinated. In the meantime, it's a good thing to wear your mask and show respect for them, even if you have been vaccinated.
Thank you. And one last question. Is there a ticking clock for teachers and child care providers who want to get the vaccine, but they have not been informed by their health district, when they'll be able to, when those specific slots are for them? And, will they be grouped in with everyone else?
No, there are still folks who work in our schools are an absolute priority. 25% to 30% have already been vaccinated. If you haven't not yet heard from your superintendent or your principal or local public health department, you will.
Welcome back, a gentleman who's been with us several times, and I remember having him on months ago when this thing first bubbled up. I remember reading this going, what, climate? That was this? Chris Herb from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, and Chris has been following this. There was a public hearing, from what I understand today, of course, a virtual hearing on this, which has been admitted in some way, shape, or form to be likely another tax on gasoline, this transportation climate initiative. Hey, Chris, Paul here. New week, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, good afternoon. You were clearly way ahead of the curve when we first started talking about this. So compliments to you making sure that your listeners were aware of this proposal that is now landed in Hartford.
Well, thanks, Chris. And I remember reading this actually like months and months ago because, you know, I have no social life. So I sit home and I read political blogs all day. And I remember, Chris, it was months and months ago, you know, and I read a little like side mention, Connecticut rumored to join Climate Pact. And I said, well, what is this? Well, now we know what this is. What has been going on today, Chris, at this virtual public hearing or with this hearing for the General Assembly?
Absolutely. So the Environment Committee in the Connecticut General Assembly is holding a virtual public hearing on a bill, Senate Bill 884, that would bless the governor signing on to a memorandum of understanding to participate in a regional program that would allow them to tax gasoline and diesel fuel with the intention of reducing emissions in Connecticut and throughout the region. The funny thing is the region only is Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and a mayor from Washington, D.C. signing on. So we're kind of alone on this one.
Yeah, it started out 12 states and D.C., but 8 of the 12 states said, or 9 of the 12 said, forget it, at least for now. I think one telling sign on this, Chris, is my buddy Mark Fitch up at the Yankee Institute. He put out a release and wrote a short piece highlighting that the Sierra Club, which last time I checked, Chris, was not a far right wing organization, doesn't like this. One, they say in focus, it doesn't go far enough. That's another discussion. But they highlighted, Chris, you probably saw this. The Sierra Club said something you and I talk about all the time. There are no protections. They say they've read it. There's no protections as to where this money can be used.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, not someone that you would expect to be against a bill that is designed, quote unquote, designed to lower emissions. And the accountability piece is part of the important reason why they did not support the legislation today. They believe that, you know, their government would be susceptible to raiding it for other purposes. Not like that ever happens, Paul, right? That never happens in Connecticut.
Never, no.
So that was the first reason. The second reason why they opposed it, according to what they've posted on their website, is that they don't believe that environmental justice communities, people who live typically in urban areas, were taken seriously in it. And the way I interpret that is that if you increase the cost to drive a car, you are disadvantaging people who are least likely to be able to afford that. It is a regressive tax that will hit low and middle income working families the hardest.
Yeah, and Chris, and I mean no disrespect at all when I say this, because I talk about this all the time, but, you know, they say this is to help some of these communities, which is great. Although, my guess is, Chris, with all good intentions, a lot of these communities are not the ones driving, you know, Teslas and other electric cars and everything where, you know, they can say, well, you know, look at what we're doing for the environment here.
That's why the bill's unfair, is because what it's going to do is it's going to build an electric charging infrastructure so people in Greenwich who can afford a Tesla will be able to drive to Hartford and other places. That will be done on the backs of single moms who are just trying to go to work, who will not be advantaged by having charging infrastructure because she's just going to have to continue to drive her gas-powered vehicle at a higher cost per gallon at the pump because of this TCI tax.
What do you say, Chris, to people, and I'm sure you must have heard the critics who say, well, come on, Chris, we get it. We know where you're coming from. Your organization represents a lot of gas stations and a lot of folks that may be losing their jobs over the next few years because of electric cars and gas electric hybrids. What's your general answer to those people, Chris?
Well, I would say that, you know, once upon a time, this was America and people chose what was in their best interest. And typically the lowest cost, most competitive, most available products are the ones that won. And gasoline happens to be that product. So until the utilities want to step up and pay for this charging infrastructure, until the electric vehicle manufacturers want to pay for this infrastructure, don't push the costs on to the average working Connecticut Joe. Don't do that. It's not fair. And by the way, you know what? Over time, my members will evolve if need be. But it'll be on the backs of those Connecticut customers.
What have you heard? Anything interesting today? Anything that stuck out from you? If you dabbled into what people were saying, if so, in these public hearings, which are still going on, which is good, but they're unique. They're video connected and coordinated. Anything strike you today or not?
Yeah, Paul. So the hearing started at 10 o'clock. The people at the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection took the first 2.5 hours. There's 145 speakers. The majority of the people who've showed up so far are testifying in support of the bill. We've had some of our members push back against that. So I think that, you know, today is not the best day for the Connecticut motorist in terms of people who want to see this tax pass and be enacted and drive up the price of gasoline and diesel fuel. It won't be the last say on it. It'll be the last time we can testify, but there'll be a lot of lobbying done between now and the time the bill would be voted on. So it's going to be a fight.
Do we know that these people are actual? I mean, you know how these hearings work sometimes, Chris. They're you know, they're people that belong to certain groups. Are these really people not speaking for themselves, or are these just people that have big, you know, kick me signs on the back of them? I don't want you to name names, but you know what I'm talking about here. You know what I mean.
Yeah, it's a mixture. You know, there are obviously some self-serving folks out there like the electric vehicle manufacturers, charging infrastructure companies. Oh. Those are the obvious ones. But then there are the people who want to see emissions lowered. And even though I respect and I think we all want a cleaner environment, the bottom line is that Connecticut doesn't move the environmental needle whatsoever by taxing gasoline. It's an inelastic commodity, which means that we're going to drive as much if it's 10, 20 or 30 cents more than we do when it's at its current price. So at the end of the day, even though these people who have good intentions, they just don't understand that there will be no net result except for higher costs, less to save for college, less to pay your mortgage and your taxes.
Chris, thank you. Chris Herr from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. Chris, enjoy the rest of the day, and we'll talk down the road, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Chris Herr there represents, yes, a lot of gasoline stations, and yes, this is going to end up probably now costing, you know, whatever, $3, $5. The Lamont folks are saying, well, it won't cost you more than 4 or 5 cents a gallon for a few years. But there are people at Tufts University up in Massachusetts, a pretty smart place to go to school, who said, no, this could go as high as 17 or 18 cents a gallon. So, and again, part of the money is going to go to build electric charging stations. Well, Isn't that great? I don't have an electric car. Right now, I don't want one. You know why I primarily don't want one? Because I can't afford one. Because I can't afford one. And where I live, my living situation, I can't charge a car overnight. I just can't.